Imagine graduating from college right now with lots of debt but no real job prospects. That's the terrifying reality for many rising and recent grads facing the worst job market in decades. As NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports, graduating at a time like this puts many people at a disadvantage for years to come.
Shayna Berenswy gave up a job 5 years ago to get a master's in public administration at an Ivy League school, thinking that degree would help her advance. Instead, she's been looking for work since she graduated nearly 2 years ago. And that's not all.
I mean, I went to NYU on student loans, so I absolutely have debt.
When I reach Berenswy in Austin, she apologizes for tiny yelps in the background. She's babysitting a friend's one-year-old to earn a little cash.
It's scary. I mean, I'm 33 years old. It's very scary to be in this position.
Berenswy's education puts her in the rarefied elite among job seekers. College graduates fare much better than those without degrees. Still, she worries the degree she paid so dearly for might actually be hurting her. So sometimes she erases it from her resume.
It's almost like people are just going to assume that because I have a master's degree, either I'm asking for more money or if something better comes along, I'm going to jump ship.
In fact, she says nothing has come along, not even waitressing gigs she's applied for. And Berenswy's starting to feel a little desperate. When her car got totaled in an accident and she had to get a new one, she tried to turn that into a networking opportunity.
In talking to the car dealer, he mentioned something about working in public service. And I mean, I'm sending my email to the car dealer, my resume to the car dealer. It's just a very surreal experience just looking for work wherever.
At a recent job fair at American University, the power dynamic is palpable. The recruiters stand confidently behind their tables as students line up 10 to 15 deep to meet them.
Hi, my name is Blair Coward. I'm a senior in the School of International Service.
Blair, nice to meet you. I'm Natalie. I'm working.
Blair Coward is a young veteran of the job fair scene.
This is my Dress for Success outfit.
On this, her 22nd birthday, she's soberly dressed in a black pantsuit and nervously clicks her pen as she jockeys for position.
Oh, I talked to him yesterday. Maybe I should go into another line.
The tables for the FBI and the Departments of Defense and Justice are by far the most popular. I overhear one student ticking off a list of federal agency booths she's visited. She loses track and refers to one as the U.S. Department of whatever, whatever. Those tables are busiest, Coward explains, because those jobs are stable. But nearly all the recruiters tell her they have only internships or senior-level jobs. Coward says she's competing against people with far more experience, even for entry-level positions.
And so do you have something lined up for after graduation?
No, unfortunately no.
You look terrified.
Yes, I am. I'm quite terrified. I'm really looking for something more permanent because after August, I'm not only unemployed, but I'm also homeless.
Coward says many of her classmates are going to graduate school rather than face that prospect. And more education does come with serious benefits. The unemployment rate for college grads is less than half that of high school grads, and some degrees are still very much in demand, such as engineering. Nevertheless, today's economy will force many grads to settle for less. John Irons is policy director for the Economic Policy Institute.
That's what we expect to see with the graduates this year, that they'll have less opportunity, they'll have lower incomes, they'll be taking different kinds of jobs than they would be if they were graduating in the height of a boom.
Irons says those who start out at a disadvantage fight to make up lost ground for years, maybe a decade or more. The damage is also psychological. In the same way that people who lived through the Great Depression might hoard food, people affected by the Great Recession are less willing to leave jobs, even if they're underpaid or unhappy. Max Caldwell is managing principal for Towers Watson, an HR consulting firm.
There's a recession mindset and an imprint, I think, on workers who are struggling to, you know, find jobs and get their footing and find a platform to grow a career inside of a organization. I think the recession, in a way, has been fairly traumatic for people trying to make that happen.
Caldwell says that's imparting another lesson for this generation of graduates, that they will have to rely less on their employers and more on themselves to take care of their careers. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Today in Your Health, we'll hear how doctors neglect proven treatment for one of the deadliest and most common conditions, high blood pressure. That story in a few minutes. Now let's hear about doctors' growing enthusiasm for vitamin D. NPR's Richard Knox reports on the use of the supplement for a range of ailments, from depression to flu.
Dr. Cliff Rosen knows a lot about vitamin D. It's necessary for strong bones, and Rosen's a leading bone specialist in Portland, Maine. So he was surprised when his wife's new physician thought she should be tested for vitamin D deficiency.
She's a runner. She's in great shape. She drinks dairy. She gets a lot of sun exposure.
Rosen points out that vitamin D is made by your skin when you're in the sun.
And so my wife said, well, why do I need to have vitamin D? And the physician just said, that's part of our measurement for wellness is what's your vitamin D level.
That's not the only doctor who's jumping on the vitamin D bandwagon. I went up the road to Freeport, Maine, and paid a call on a family practitioner named James Donahue.
Hi, James Donahue.
Yeah, hi.
Pleased to meet you. Come on back. We've friends.
How long have you been measuring vitamin D levels in patients?
Aggressively in about the past year.
Right after he went to a conference in Boston.
I listened to one of the speakers who was talking about vitamin D research, and came back, and out of curiosity, I did the next 10 patients for vitamin D levels. And of the 10 patients, the only patient came up normal was low normal, and everybody was subnormal. And that's pretty much been my experience when I test.
Recently, Donahue hasn't even been bothering to test patients' vitamin D levels. He just goes ahead and says, you should be taking vitamin D.
Far and away, the majority of the patients in my patient population are taking vitamin D or paying attention to vitamin D supplementation.
The guy who got Donahue and thousands of other U.S. doctors looking for vitamin D deficiency is Dr. Michael Hollick of Boston University. He discovered the active form of the vitamin 40 years ago. Lately, he's been beating the drum in medical journals and popular books, including one coming out next month that calls vitamin D deficiency our most common health problem.
Vitamin D is very important for your overall health and well-being.
Hollick has a long list of ailments he says vitamin D supplements can prevent: osteoporosis, cancer, heart disease, diabetes, multiple sclerosis, depression, Alzheimer's, autism, tuberculosis, even the flu. He also claims success in using high doses of D to treat some conditions, such as a woman who came in with severe muscle pain.
Found that she was vitamin D deficient, corrected her vitamin D deficiency, and within 2 months she came back to me and said that I've changed her life.
Hollick also says vitamin D treatments have stopped the progression of multiple sclerosis in several of his patients. But some experts say not so fast.
We need to keep in mind the lessons of history.
That's Dr. Joanne Manson. She's chief of preventive medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston.
It was believed that megadoses of vitamin E, vitamin C, beta-carotene, selenium, folic acid, and the B vitamins would confer a large array of health benefits.
But it didn't turn out that way. In fact, one large study found, to everybody's surprise, that patients who took beta-carotene had a higher risk of lung cancer. Manson's just starting a major study funded by the National Institutes of Health. It'll assign 20,000 Americans to take vitamin D supplements, omega-3 supplements, or placebos to see if either nutrient prevents cancer, heart disease, or other ailments. But that'll take 5 years. Meanwhile, the bandwagon's rolling. Medicare payments for vitamin D tests nearly quadrupled from 2006 to 2008. Until study results are in, Cliff Rosen, the bone specialist in Portland, Maine, says taking vitamin D is a way to hedge your bets.
It's a safe enough approach to preventive medicine. The question is it preventive?
Rosen and Manson are contributing to a report from the National Institute of Medicine on how much vitamin D people should get. It's due out this summer. Richard Knox, NPR News.
NPR's business news starts with China sending a foreign executive to prison. A court in Shanghai has sentenced four executives of an international mining company to jail. One was an Australian citizen. The men were working for the mining giant Rio Tinto. The case has riveted the foreign business community in China. NPR's Louisa Lim was in the courtroom and has this report.
Australian Stern Hu gave no visible reaction when his sentence of 10 years in prison was read out. Foreign journalists had been allowed to watch the verdict on closed-circuit television. Hu and three Chinese Rio Tinto employees were found guilty of accepting bribes and violating commercial secrets. The longest sentence was 14 years, handed down to an employee found guilty of taking $9 million in bribes. In the matter of commercial secrets, the court said the men had collected information about closed meetings held by the China Iron and Steel Association. It said the actions of the four Rio Tinto employees had caused losses of about $150 million to China's steel industry and seriously damaged its competitiveness. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.
By the mid-19th century, Britain was an almost unchallenged empire. It controlled about a fifth of the world's surface, and yet its Achilles heel, its weakness, had everything to do with tea. The British public loved tea. And by 1800, it was far and away the most popular drink in the country. The problem was that all the tea produced in the world came from China, and Britain couldn't control the quality or the price. So around 1850, a group of British businessmen set out to create a tea industry in a place they did control, India.
The task required a plant hunter, a gardener, a thief, a spy. The man Britain needed was named Robert Fortune.
That's Sarah Rose reading from her new book, For All the Tea in China. It tells a story of what she calls the greatest single act of corporate espionage in history. The story of how Britain sent an agent to China to steal its tea and end that country's dominance of the tea trade. Sarah Rose is at NPR's New York studio. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Guy, for having me.
So basically, you had the system where Britain was shipping opium to China. China was shipping tea back. Why did Britain feel like it had to get into the tea business?
The Chinese emperor hated that opium was the medium of exchange because a nation of drug addicts was being created. So the emperor confiscated all the opium, destroyed it all. England sent warships. At the end of the day, they realized that if they were going to keep pace with the British tea consumption and not deal with the Chinese, they had to own it for themselves.
This is where Robert Fortune comes in, and he is the one who sort of guides the narrative here. Tell us who Robert Fortune was.
Robert Fortune was a botanist, a horticulturalist, at a time when botany and the natural sciences were on the ascent in Britain. A great deal of them had university educations and were trained as doctors. Robert Fortune was Scottish, but grew up quite poor. And so he kind of worked his way through the ranks of professional botany, learning with hands-on training instead of book training.
And by the time he reaches his early 30s, he goes on a trip to China. This is around 1845. It's a two-year trip, just in search of plants. You talk about how he then publishes a travelogue of his adventures where he sort of fights off pirates, and it kind of captures the imagination of Victorian society.
He was attacked by pirates. He was attacked by bandits. He encountered all kinds of disease and storms, and he also goes in Chinese disguise, dressed up as if he were a wealthy Chinese merchant. I don't know if it captured the imagination of the Victorians, but that certainly captured mine, that notion of cultural transvestitism.
And this book that he publishes, the sort of diary of his exploits, makes a round, and by 1848, he is approached by a representative from the East India Company, at the time one of the most important, if not the most important, multinational corporation in the world.
The East India Company says to him, "We need to go back to China and hunt up some tea for us." They wanted really good tea stock from the very best gardens in China. And they also needed experts. They needed the Chinese to go to India to teach the British planters as well as the Indian gardeners.
So Fortune manages to get his seeds to India. And within his lifetime, India actually surpasses China as the world's biggest tea grower. I mean, it's a pretty astonishing turnabout in such a short period of time.
It astonishes me. China has pretty much never really come back from that, certainly not in the Western markets. Now that Asia has such a booming economy, the Chinese are again pretty fierce tea producers, but it took 100-plus years.
Do you regard Robert Fortune as history's greatest corporate thief or the man we can thank for the tea we drink?
I think he thought of himself as a China expert and a gardener. He didn't see himself as stealing something that didn't belong to him. He thought plants belonged to everybody.
That's Sarah Rose. She's the author of the book, For All the Tea in China, How England Stole the World's Favorite Drink and Changed History. Sarah Rose, thank you so much.
Thank you.
About an hour east of Washington, D.C., in a forest along the banks of the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland, the trees are all of a sudden growing faster. Much faster than ever before, in some parts twice as fast, and scientists now believe they figured out the mystery. This is a pretty typical mid-Atlantic forest, oaks, hickory trees, tall tulip poplars that grow straight up like Roman columns. And to get there, you have to drive past a security guard and down a winding road.
So welcome to Cirque. I guess you've never been out here before.
That's our guide, the ecologist Jess Parker. And on a recent morning, he took us deep inside the forest on the grounds of the Smithsonian Institution's Environmental Research Center.
I leave the keys here, okay? Just so you know.
There are thousands of trees here, and every single one is mapped. Parker literally carries that map with thousands of colored dots on it. And he leads us into a part of the forest where a group of volunteers and researchers is taking measurements.
8.5. Okay, and the number?
070610.
070610. Got it.
Some of the trees here are 300 years old, and each one, each poplar or oak or hickory tree, is tagged with an ID number. Around some of them is a thin band made from metal. It's called a dendrometer, and it's used to measure the tree's circumference. And almost every single day since he started working in this forest more than 20 years ago, Jess Parker has monitored these trees.
You came here the first day and you said, I need to measure trees.
Yes, you might as well get started.
And recently, he decided to gather up all that data he has collected over those 20-plus years, the measurements, the changes in temperature and carbon levels, and crunch the numbers. And he noticed something astonishing.
In taking all the data from these different plots of different ages, we assembled the general pattern of how forests around here grow. But when we looked on that graph of what individual plots were doing, such as this one right here, we discovered that it was growing at a much higher rate than you would expect for the forest of its age. So this 130-year-old forest here is growing faster than one would expect from that general pattern.
How much faster?
Well, we put this usually in metric terms, on the order of 3 metric tons of biomass per hectare per year. And in some cases, that's double. In some cases, it's just an extra 50%. And the pattern that we see, we believe, is relatively recent.
And Jess Parker believes the forests are growing faster because of climate change.
Over the 23-year period that we've done this project, the average temperature has gone up by about 0.3 of a degree C.
In this forest?
Yes, and in the region in general. The length of the growing season, as defined from the time of the last frost in the spring to the first frost in the fall, has increased by about a week. And the CO2 level in the atmosphere has gone up by about 12%. Now, each of those effects is known to be able to stimulate the growth of trees. And so it's not at all unlikely that brought together all three of those could have been involved in the extra growth that we're seeing.
Can you explain how an increase in carbon contributes to more rapid growth of a forest?
Well, we know that in experimental settings, when you fertilize the atmosphere around plants with extra CO2, they grow faster.
So it acts like a fertilizer.
In a sense, yes.
Is this something localized here in the Mid-Atlantic or even on the eastern along the eastern seaboard? Or do you know if this phenomenon is happening somewhere else around the world?
There have been numerous reports in the literature of extra growth in forests throughout the world.
What kind of consequences would there be for weather patterns in the area?
If the trees are growing faster and longer, they're probably also transpiring water more. Extra water vapor in the atmosphere can affect the amount of cloudiness, and that can affect the heat balance of the lower atmosphere. I'm not sure how that will translate into the local weather here in the D.C. area, but it's likely to have a large-scale effect.
So could it mean more extreme weather, like the snowstorms we experienced here in Washington, D.C. this past winter? Scientists don't know, and as Jess Parker led us back out of the forest, he said it's probably too early to know anyway.
Are you worried about this?
About what?
What's happening here?
No, I'm just amazed by it. We discovered this in our data a year or so ago.
I mean, you're not alarmed by it?
No, I guess I'm personally not alarmed. I'm very curious about the whole thing, what's causing it, how far it can go on, and what its other effects might be. But alarmed, I wouldn't say so.
To see photographs of the forest and to find a link to Jess Parker's study, visit our website, npr.org.
Let's turn now to NPR's Koki Roberts, who joins us most Mondays to talk about politics. Good morning.
Hi, Renee.
Well, Koki, for all the excitement around the Tea Party, from what we've just heard, do you have any idea of how much of a force the Tea Party might be in the coming congressional elections?
Well, you know, they in polls that they're about equally supported and disapproved of, one by Quinnipiac University, says basically half of Americans don't know who they are, and the other half are pretty equally divided. The question about Sarah Palin, who is clearly the hero of the movement when it comes to these kinds of rallies, she remains more people disapproving of her than approving of her. One of the things about the Tea Party movement that has gotten the attention of a lot of politicians, though, is that how many women are involved in it. And that is unusual for something that is basically a conservative cause. And I thought it was interesting that Palin said to this big crowd, "We're not going to sit down and shut up," which is kind of a rallying cry for women who feel like they've often been asked to do that. The Washington Post poll over the weekend showed that if the Tea Party fields candidates of its own rather than trying to win, say, a Republican Party nomination, it will hurt the Republicans in November. That would be one of the few things the Democrats have to be happy about.
Well, what about the health care law itself? After all the political drama to get there, is there any indication that it will even make a difference this November?
Well, it might for the man the Tea Party is were aiming at in Nevada, Democratic leader Harry Reid, who seems to just be going down in the polls. But in general, we've seen some slight uptick for the Democrats when voters are asked, which party do you want to represent you your district in November? The Democrats were tying or slightly ahead in some polls where they had been behind since the health care bill. So it probably shows that their judgment was right, that doing nothing was worse than doing something, so they don't seem hapless to the voters. But the voters are still deeply divided on the issue of health care itself. But even at this moment, Renee, of this fever pitch on the issue, 40% in the Washington Post poll say how their member voted on health care won't matter this fall. And you know that's probably right. There's lots of real-world experience to come between now and then, and the economy will be everything. Two-thirds or close to it still say the country is off on the wrong track, and that's the real problem for the party in power in November.
Well, that's interesting because both parties, the Democrats and Republicans, seem determined to keep talking about health care. I mean, Speaker Pelosi and President Obama are holding rallies supporting it this weekend. Republicans are keeping up a drum roll for repeal. Is that really like that ladder likely to go anywhere?
I can't believe it. Now, they keep talking about a health care bill back in the 1980s that was repealed. And that was quite something to witness because the Democratic Congress, President Reagan, and the old folks lobbying group, the AARP, had all supported this what was called catastrophic health insurance bill, where more wealthy elderly people paid the premiums of less wealthy elderly people in case of health disaster. And both sides, both the more and the less wealthy, decided they hated the bill and protested against it, famously against the then chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Danny Rostenkowski, where they surrounded his car. And members of Congress sort of threw up their hands and said, okay, if the people who are benefiting from this bill don't like it either, we will repeal it. But the problem then was that it wasn't really what anybody wanted at the time. What they were looking for was long-term health care, not this type of health care. Right now, we're in a very different position of the kinds of things that are in this, particularly the kinds of things that will go into effect right away. And I think that Republicans would be very hard-pressed to repeal such things as pre-existing conditions for children not being allowed, taking that away.
Koki, thanks very much. NPR's Koki Roberts.